I won't take any leftover questions, but I do want to mention one other thing that might help us understand all this. It's the where would you get this consciousness? You can't get it from learning about it. Something has to happen within that converts you to it. And the way it happened for me was that in the seminary, they had invited Daniel Berrigan to give a talk. And I admired him and his stance on nonviolence. The Vietnam War was going on. And gradually I saw that the war was immoral. And when I was ordained, I was in a parish that had a very active Quaker group. And I took an interest in what they were doing, and I started to join in with them with their various nonviolent demonstrations. And I met people through their group that became lifelong friends. And gradually I realized, this is from Berrigan and from the Quakers, it's not just that this war is immoral, it's that all war is immoral, and that this is our teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. So that's when I felt this change happening within me, and it couldn't come from just reading something. So I want to throw that out to everybody that you're listening to this and you're paying attention and you're thinking about it, and then just keep yourself open to how something could happen in you that might make this meaningful. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that you could never wait until everybody else is doing it. This is something that you would only do because you wanted to do it on your own. You say, well, I'll wait till everybody else turns the other cheek, then I'll do it. It doesn't go that way. It has nothing to do with what everybody else does. And that helps us understand that we could even be part of a church community that mostly did not follow this. That there were always some saints and some little groups, many burned at the stake for their beliefs, but there were always little splinter groups who pointed in a prophetic way to this particular set of teachings and said, this is the way to go, we want to follow these. But the official church never stated in any definite way or at all that this is the style of all Catholics. As you'll see later in the presentation, probably next week, I'm going to go into all the ways that the various religious groups have answered the question, if this is the Christian teaching, how do we explain that we don't demand it as part of being a Catholic or a Protestant, etc.? That's a big question, which I'm going to. Why is it that we haven't said a Catholic is one who follows the Sermon on the Mount? Instead, we said a Catholic is one who follows the Nicene Creed. So that's a big question for all religious groups. And we're going to hear how the Catholic answer to it and Luther's answer and so forth. You'll find it very fascinating. But in any case, we can't wait for the church to tell us that this is the teaching that we're now ready to follow. Nor could the church ever demand it, because you have to have the grace to go with it. See, the church can say, you can't eat meat on Friday. Because any person could not eat meat on Friday. But the church can't say, you have to turn the other cheek. Because to turn the other cheek, to espouse nonviolence, to be a pacifist, which is what it's all about, requires a special kind of journey and a special kind of grace that you've responded to. Even though the last pope, John Paul II, was a full-on pacifist, he gave 80 talks just against the Gulf War, against how all war is immoral. That was his belief. But he could never impose that on the Catholic community because he knows, no, you can't legislate that. Each person has to come to it in his own way. So St. Francis got there, and St. Clair got there, and John Paul II got there, and whoever else got there. But you can't force it on an entire community. Does this make sense, everybody?
Yeah.
So that helps us understand what we call hypocrisy. But it isn't totally hypocrisy because nowhere was it ever stated that this Sermon on the Mount is exactly how we would behave. Yeah. It's a calling that that many people have responded to, but it's not one that could be forced on us.
Well, I was thinking of religious communities, Poor Clares and Carmelites, and they
follow this.
They
teachings.
Follow it,
yes.
But it is their choice to join that order.
Yeah, it's a vocation, which means calling.
Sort of, yeah. In the sense that they are lofty goals rather than laws.
There you go. Yeah, lofty goals rather than laws. That's a good way to put it. Basically, the church says there's one set of requirements for salvation. So that would be your Ten Commandments and so forth. And there's another set of teachings for perfection. Sermon on the Mount is in this category. It's for perfection, not for salvation. It's not required for salvation in Catholic theology. It's only the calling for those who want the loftier perfection. So religious life was thought of as oh, well, that's the path of perfection. Now we know that's for lay people too.
That's a really dangerous distinction.
Yes, absolutely.
Because now some people say, well, we're better than you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's been used that way. I mean, clericalism and all sorts of stuff come from that.
Yeah, and it goes back to, how we thought of the clergy is a higher state than the lay people.
And along with that, let me just add that, if you think of some of the ways the Sermon on the Mount has been preached, a lot of it is situational. You don't tell a battered flag to turn the other cheek.
Mm-hmm.
So, these ideals have to be applied, and there's always some give and take there that you have to make a judgment about.
Mm.
So,
yeah, and you have to work within a community to work out, or with people that you trust, to work out how you're going to do this, rather than take it literally.
Yeah, well, literally is hopeless. It's hopeless, yeah, because then it can become a weapon to use against other people.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's why the
that's
church,
our conflict.
In her wisdom, was very careful not to
legislated.
Legislated.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, I think the church has acted all right. I think they know what they're dealing with. Thank you, Lord.
No problem. Jeannie?
I think you can enhance the values in the Sermon on the Mount by legislation. I mean, the civil rights movement, for example. I mean, justice requires that the law uphold it, I think. I mean, it,
good point.
You may not, people's hearts do have to change, but let's face it, people's hearts have changed, but they never would have without the legislation that was passed.
That's a very good point.
Johnson's.
Yes. So changing the law can lead to a change of heart.
Yeah. Would you think that the Sermon on the Mount is like a seed that was planted, but yet we as a community, as individuals, have not evolved psychologically or spiritually to receive that? Because that's, I think, what you say about the last pope, in a sense, unless you have peace and you've resolved a lot of things within yourself, I don't know how you can really think in that other way unless it's just an intellectual. But I don't know.
Yeah, it would have to be a personal change in you, transformation of some kind. Okay, any other questions left over? We learned a lot from these discussions. Harriet?
The other thing that occurs to me back when you wrote the things on the board about the special calling and the people that have the, you know, turning the other cheek or allowing things to be stolen. To me, that outlines a prophetic person. Somebody, you know, you mentioned Daniel Berry Dibner, people that really are role models for us and have gone beyond just what is the normal way of operating. But I think there's another part to them in this, that they can turn the other cheek, they can allow stealing to happen. But it seems to me that they also would not expect us to do that. They wouldn't lay that expectation on us.
No, exactly. Because you have to be willing to go to jail, willing to die like Martin Luther King or Gandhi.
Yeah.
Not everybody is called to that.
No.
Yes?
It's interesting to think of the difference between this applying to an individual and applying to the community. Because if the community kept turning the other cheek, then mass murderers would be allowed to operate freely. And limits have to be drawn.
Yeah. You wouldn't want, as I was saying to Barbara during the break, you wouldn't want someone on the Supreme Court who was following the Sermon on the Mount carefully, because that would contradict the Constitution. So his special gift of understanding the Constitution and rightly interpreting it, that's his gift. And that would fit with this particular approach. See what I mean? You see the conflict that this whole topic brings up? It's very fascinating. Because there's no right and wrong. There's no black and white to it. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, so this is Luke's interpretation of the Sermon on the Mount?
No, this is his version of the Sermon on the Mount. Kind of a shortened form, but it's probably based on the same source as the Matthew. But the same concepts are in the Matthew version.
Maybe it was the Matthew version that when I went to St. Raymond's grade school, we memorized this. We memorized those, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children.
The Beatitudes. Yeah.
Oh, the Beatitudes are the Sermon on the Mount.
No, that's just the opening introduction.
Okay.
Yeah. And the rest of it goes on from there.
Okay. So I think we got the idea that Beatitudes was the whole thing.
No. It starts with the Beatitudes and then it goes to the rest of it.
Okay.
We're talking about what in my mind is the tension between law and grace. And what does St. Paul say about the law was necessary until the freedom that comes with grace? Well, that takes an evolution of consciousness. It takes a shift in our own consciousness of our rootedness in the Trinity, which is being resurrected these past 20 years or so, to explain that God is not a single solitary self or person, but rather a communion of persons in loving relationships. So rather than even lofty goals, I would say our heritage comes from the fact that we were birthed out of a loving relationship, persons in loving relationship. And any time there are persons in loving relationship, there is God in the world. And this loving relationship has no hierarchy. It's mutual. It's reciprocal. It's equal. And so when we're in relationships where the give and take, it's the receiving, the self-emptying, the receiving, that type of relationality actually gave birth to us. And so when we divide ourselves up against everything, we become violent because we do violence to what is in us, you know, in our deepest self. And so we're trying to return. We are. I mean, that's the movement. If you look at how can we all get along, so to speak, that I think psychologically that's a deep, deep motivation coming out of humanity today, is recognizing that we're all one, but yet different. So there's a diversity in the Trinity, but there's also a unity. And that's paradox, you know. But so we're returning home when we become universally a communion of persons in loving relationship, and that includes the earth, because everything's included in that. So there's a need in my mind when we can sit in silence and our roots can go deep into this experience, then something shifts within ourselves, but we can't know it just theoretically. We have to experience it interiorly, and we have to get quiet enough to be able to do that. So there's a need in the world for silence and quiet, especially in today's world, so that we can return home to our deepest self. But the law embraced tension. Until then, we still need the law. You know, you're right. And now we're living in this tension between law and the final freedom of ourselves to manifest ourselves as the glory of God in relation with God.
Thank you, Alice. Okay, so let's take a look at the Beatitudes, which are the way the whole sermon begins, and you had already given some quotations. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, so forth. It talks about those who mourn, the meek, those who are hungry for justice because they're not receiving it, the merciful, the pure of heart, the peacemakers, those who are persecuted. Beatitudes are a literary form, and basically they show that you're in a blessed state when you have virtue or good fortune. And the Beatitudes of Jesus reverse that and say when you have bad fortune, when things aren't working out, you are blessed. So now we're the sermon here at the beginning refers to the lower classes of the society, people who had no money. I'll talk about the difference between the poor and the destitute shortly. And poverty, hunger, sorrow, persecution are thought of as signs of God's grace coming to you. So there's a reversal, and that's that same word that Alice used, shift, in how we look at things. So wealth is not as important as the kingdom, and the kingdom is better described as the community of those whom society looks down upon. Those who are in desperate need, they're helpless, and the idea of poor in spirit and poor according to Crossan, should not be thought of as different. Both refer to being poor. But it's not just an economic term. It's the people who were not given all the goodies of the society. So they didn't achieve the dream that society offers. And you might also think of it as poor in the sense of lacking ego. Crossan shows the difference between the word poor in Greek is penitos, but he doesn't use that word when he says blessed are the poor. He uses this word, tokoi, P-T-O-C-H-O-I, which means destitute. Literally, it means one who's crouching down. So there were two kinds of people in the society. There were the poor people who did not have time for leisure activity because they spent all their time working. But they made enough money to live on, but only enough to live on. And they usually did own some property, at least the house that they were in. But the destitute person had nothing going for him, a homeless person. He had lost any social standing, maybe lost family ties even. Often a wanderer, no fixed abode. And Crossan describes them as unclean, degraded, and expendable. Those are the people that he says are blessed. Do you see how this reverses the whole concept of the way society sees things? When he says, blessed are the meek, he uses a Greek word that is used again when he says, learn from me, for I am meek and humble of heart. And it refers to a gentle, nonviolent style. Not meek in our sense of let people get away with things. It does not refer to that. It means don't do anything harmful. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and he did not fight back. He won't harm others, not because he's weak, but because he loves them. He wouldn't harm others even if he could. That's the concept of this kind of meekness. And the same word was used upon the entry into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. And Crossan uses this phrase, this triumphant one will not rely on violence or military might. So the usual way to get something done, violence and military might, he will not go that way. So this is a new vision of the reign of God. Another way of saying kingdom. The poor, the hungry, the afflicted are the privileged benefactors of this kingdom. Not because they're more religious or more upright, but only because of their sorry state. Imagine that. He's not saying, oh, well, they're nicer people. He's saying anybody that's this messed up goes to the front of the line in my kingdom. It's a real reversal. So it's a comment on how God loves compassionately, a special solicitude for the oppressed and the disinherited, the exiled. And this is the answer to how we would love God. We love others in the same way that God loves them. And again, not the God that's up in the sky, but the God that's in them and in us. Now, when he says, blessed are the persecuted, this is the, Luke has it as, when they hate, revile, and exclude you, contemptuous abuse, Crossan calls this, a kingdom of nobodies. He's assembling a kingdom of nobodies. And this is probably related to, this part about the persecution is related to the history of the early church, in which was a style of being persecuted. We don't, we can't really quite get how real this was. Because in the year 64, Nero declared that Christianity was illegal and that Christians should be killed. And then I went through the history of the early times. So I'll give you a few examples of the various ways that they were Christians were persecuted. Not all the emperors between Nero in 64 and Constantine in 313, not all of them persecuted Christians. Some paid no attention at all. So they had periods of peace. Septimius Severus in 202 made a law prohibiting the spread of Christianity or Judaism. Maximinus in 235 exiled all the bishops. Decius in 250 made an edict that all Romans had to sacrifice to the gods and get a certificate showing that they had sacrificed, or else they would be persecuted. Valerian in 253 said all the clergy have to sacrifice to the gods, all the Christian clergy, bishops, priests, and deacons, deaconesses, so forth. And then he said all the laity have to do it also. Diocletian in 284, whose own wife and daughter were Christians, you can see how things were changing. He persecuted the church for 20 years, burned all the churches, burned the scriptures, imprisoned Christians, tortured them, killed them, deprived all Christians of public office and their civil rights, made a law, you have to sacrifice to the gods or die. Christians also had avoided the food that was sprinkled with sacrificial wine by the pagan priests. So Diocletian arranged it that all the food would be sprinkled by the pagan priests in honor of the gods, which meant you'd have to starve to death or betray your faith. They didn't want to eat food that had been sprinkled. Then finally, Galerius had tolerance in 311, and Constantine in 313 made the law that there'll be no further persecutions of Christians. Later, he also made a law that there be no further crucifixions, because now the cross was honored as a religious symbol. By 313, about one out of every 10 Romans was Christian. And by 416, Theodosius II, imagine this change. Here you have Christians can't serve in the army because some of them were following the Sermon on the Mount, only some. But the main reason was that in order to get into the army, you had to take an oath. The word for oath is sacramentum. That's where we get sacrament. You took an oath to honor the emperor as a god. So, of course, if you were a Christian, you couldn't join the army because of the sacramentum requirement. 416, get this, see how things change. Only Christians can serve in the army. No pagans allowed. He thought this was a way of converting more people, because you want to join, you'll become a Christian. Isn't that interesting? See how things have changed? We don't quite appreciate the role of persecution in the preservation of the pure teachings. Because by the time you get to 416, where you have the emperor saying, you have to be a Christian to join the armies, it's the opposite of the Sermon on the Mount. And the fact that he would say such a thing shows that Christians were willing to join. So when they weren't persecuted, they did not hold on to the type of teachings that are in the Sermon on the Mount. This makes us wonder if they fit better in a persecuted society where you're willing to go to the lions rather than deny your faith. Brings up that question. Interesting. Okay, any questions about that part?
Yeah, it just makes you think, why be a Christian?
Because something happens in you that moved you that way. And there's
what
nothing
was
you
it
can...
about the message? What was it about that period? Was it this challenge or just the thought that the destitute, the poor, the underbelly of society were well received by this God? And is that the force that has made Christianity last 2,000 years?
That certainly was appealing. Here was a religion in which you could, whether you were a slave or a free person, you were equal. That made a big difference.
That brings jumping.
No, it's okay.
Another question. Because many of the people that Paul addresses in his letters were people who had property. They were the heads of churches. And these were usually the landed, the wealthy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They did it all the way. Those are the Christians who had property. They gave it to the community.
Yes.
They didn't keep it for themselves.
Yes.
They shared it out.
That's a good point. And somehow this was appealing in ancient times because they had never, people had never seen this reversal. It was a radical alternative to the empire. And by the way, don't ever be fooled. The reason that the emperors were suspicious of Christianity is not because they love one another, they have beliefs in Jewish prophet who lived under Roman rule so many years ago. It's not about that. It was that they noticed that an alternative society was flourishing within their own within their own society, and they felt it as a threat. It was felt as a political threat. That explains why Constantine, when he noticed, okay, we've gotten to the point where we can't keep persecuting these Christians because more and more people are joining, what I'm going to do is consolidate the empire by making Christianity its state religion ultimately. It always had something to do with the survival of the political system. So we were persecuted when we were threatening the political system. But once we had joined the political system, you have to be a Christian to be a soldier, we were no longer a threat, we were no longer persecuted. Then you're going to see less of the Sermon on the Mount. Then it's only going to be the little groups of monks and nuns going off into the desert who are acting like that. Because the rest of us are acting in accord with the ordinary values of the society. This is such an important point. Because I always wondered, well, why were they persecuting us? What do they care what we believe? It isn't about that. They didn't care what you believe. All they care about is you're setting up an alternative to what we have going here. And it's threatening us. So it has to be stamped out.
As soon as you start empowering the masses and raising people's value and dignity up, it's a disturbance in the system. And, you know, I remember I told this story so many times, so forgive me if you've heard it, but it made a tremendous difference to me years ago when I heard differing interpretations of the parable of the talents, depending on whether you lived in a first world country or whether you lived in a third world country. Because, and there are two different versions in Matthew and in Luke, but the question to Jesus was, will the kingdom come soon? And then he takes off on the story about a king that goes away and leaves all of his value with his stewards, and they were supposed to make more for him. So in first world countries, I've always heard that interpreted as the bad guy who wanted to bury his talents, and he didn't. So we're supposed to as Catholics, we need to use our gifts to, further the Catholic Church in the world. And so that's how it was taught, and I think that's a legitimate interpretation. But then I heard in third world countries, he's the good guy because he buries his gifts because he refuses to participate in a system that's oppressing the poor. And what happened to him? He died. And so the question Jesus is asking is, what are you willing to do for the kingdom to come? It's going to take us believing in ourselves. And, there are always good people on top also who do see injustice
and
systems. But those two different interpretations, depending on where you are in society, make a huge difference, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think they're both legitimate. It's just that, you can see that the courage it takes to change, to step up and believe in yourself.
We're going to wind up in a couple minutes, but many of the books that I refer to get all this together made this point in common, both Catholic and Protestant. They raise the question, is Christianity the kind of religion that only really thrives in persecution? As long as we're the established, acceptable, tax-free church, all part of the system of our society, could we really accept the kind of challenge that is in the Sermon on the Mount? It seems more likely that it's meant for a persecuted community rather than one that's hand in glove with the dominant powers, which is what we are. We're hand in glove with the political powers. We're not some little splinter group on the outside.
Well, that brings up the question of how these Gospels were written then, because they were written by people who were being persecuted.
Yes.
And so they would emphasize that viewpoint in their writing.
Exactly. And what these books brought up was this question, which we have no final answer. Does it work best, and is it meant for a persecuted group? And that once you're no longer persecuted, you would no longer follow this so carefully. You would just go back to your standard Ten Commandments.
It's the history of the Jews, that when they were in slavery in Egypt, they were very open and receptive to being saved out of their misery. But then when they came into the Promised Land, that's why we needed the prophets to arise, because then they took off and became oppressors themselves of surrounding nations, mm-hmm. and then the prophets came in and said, we're supposed to take care of the aliens, the foreigners and the aliens and the widows and the orphans, the most marginalized, because we ourselves were slaves in Egypt. And so it seems like it's a pattern of human behavior that once we get saved or come out of it, we then become the
persecutors. Great.
There's a great letter to the editor in today's paper. It's a quote by Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, about calling kind of the country back to its original roots, that we came here for freedom, but then we forgot where we came from. And anyhow, so I think it's human nature, let's say, to...
Yes, and in psychology, it's expressed very simply with this triangle. That at one end of on one angle of the triangle is victim, and on the other angle of the triangle is persecutor. Everybody, other people have seen this?
Oh yeah.
Okay. So sometimes you're the victim, and other people persecute you, but at other times the persecutor, the other times it gets reversed, and the one who was the victim becomes persecutor. And the alternative is the rescuer. That's the third angle. But what happens is the rescuer comes and saves the victim, and then the victim becomes the persecutor. So the first version is the persecutor is persecuting the victim who is saved by the rescuer. But then the rescuer saves the victim who becomes the persecutor.
Does the persecutor ever become the rescuer?
It's a good alternative. So first, Nero was persecuting us, and then Constantine rescued us, and then we started burning people at the stake who don't agree with our point of view, and keeps going around the circle. All right, well, our time is about up, and I'll go on next week to the next part of this, and we'll see you then. So thank you.